This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm Jerry Collins Bride, and together with my partner Lucy Crane, we're hosting this series on developmental disabilities. So thank you all for coming out in the evening to hear our speaker tonight. We're very happy to have Dr. Clarissa Kripke, who is a faculty in the Department of Family and Community Medicine. Dr. Chris Kripke has been working in this arena for at least the past 10 years, has been really instrumental in doing a lot of policy work on to provide better care for people with developmental disabilities. She's the director of the Office of Developmental Primary Care and is here tonight to talk about a successful community living for people with disabilities. Dr. Kripke.
Thank you, Jerry. It's an honor because Jerry is such an esteemed colleague. I really enjoy working with you. So I have nothing to disclose. I'm the mom of an autistic teen. Of course, I want what's best for him. I want him to have opportunity, stability, care, and respect. After trying to learn everything that I could, I realized that wanting what's best and knowing how to achieve it are two completely different things. Fortunately, we live in California. The Lanterman Act was developed by and for parents. It was signed into law by Ronald Reagan in the 1970s. A generation of parents and visionary lawmakers had the wisdom to see a future where people with developmental disabilities could have the same opportunities as everybody else, not separated or segregated, fully included. Since that law has passed, our population has doubled, and yet the vast majority of people with developmental disabilities remain in the community, where they live, work, laugh, and cry like everybody else. The Lanterman Act has been immensely successful on so many levels. I'm also a family physician specializing in the primary care of adults with developmental disabilities. This gives me the privilege of learning directly from people with disabilities what's best for them, and to witness firsthand how the Lanterman Act has been an advocate for them in protecting their right to receive care as fully included citizens. Before the Lanterman Act, families had to wait for placement in institutional centers, and while they waited, they didn't have alternatives in their local communities. If they wanted an education for their kids, they had to create one. Other states are still years behind. They rely on outdated institutional models of care and lack community-based resources. Waiting lists for getting any services are still the norm. Parents are desperate. In California, the Lanterman Act mandates a system of regional centers. Regional centers are required to respond to the needs of local people and to keep families and communities together. They strive to maximize the potential of people with developmental disabilities of all ages. We're far better off than in other parts of the country. Let's hear from Carol, who's a parent leader who has been around since the beginning of the regional center system.
Because there were enough of us that were young parents, maybe if I'd been more isolated and been the only young parent, I wouldn't have. But we were, you know, this was, you know, back when, you know, we were talking about in the 70s, you know, and a lot of progressive thinking was starting to come forward. We all had a desire to continue, to not think that there were boundaries, that if you put boundaries on anything, as we, you know, at my age, I've learned all these years, you can put boundaries on yourself and you'll have no experiences. The more experiences and boundaries you break down and look for new opportunities, then that's when you find things. We were all young enough to have an open mind and also to want to find something different, not to just accept what they told us and not to just say, okay, we're just going to, this is, you know, throw up your hands. We can't do anything. None of us felt that way. And Atypical Infant Development was a new program at that point that they were trying to strive to do the same thing, to provide parents with that opportunity. And it was a great program. We feel fortunate that we were in this Marin County as well, because I have a friend that was in Texas, and there was not any programs available. and you didn't even have, you know, UC Med Center was, there was nothing close by that was even thinking about doing anything for children with Down syndrome or any, you know, disabilities. And Down syndrome is, you know, there's a whole array of disabilities that should be addressed. In nowadays, there's much more, and the operations are being done on a routine basis, but there's other areas that that money needs to be going towards and programs that need to be developed.
The Lanterman Act articulates a set of values that guides my personal life as a parent and as a professional. The state of California accepts a responsibility for people with developmental disabilities and an obligation to them, which it must discharge. The complexities of providing services and supports requires the coordination of many state departments and community agencies to ensure that no gaps occur. A consumer shall have a leadership role in service design. An array of services should be established, which is sufficiently complete to meet the needs and choices of each person, regardless of age or degree of disability, and to support integration into the mainstream of the community. Services should be available throughout the state to prevent dislocation from home communities. Services should enable people to approximate the pattern of everyday living available to people without disabilities. Consumers should be empowered to make choices in all life areas. These include promoting opportunities to be integrated into the mainstream of life in their home communities, including supported living and other appropriate community living arrangements. Consumers should participate in decisions affecting their own lives, including where and with whom they live, their relationships with people in their community, and the way they spend their time and pursue their own personal future. The contributions made by parents and family members in support of their children and relatives are important, and those relationships should be respected and fostered. The values and attitudes that people can have either support or create barriers for people with disabilities. Do any of the following attitudes sound familiar to you? We don't want your kids as neighbors. His behavior is disruptive. Our playgrounds and sidewalks and buses and schools aren't accessible. He'll be isolated. He won't have friends. They won't have work or meaningful activity. He might wander or make noise or damage property. They might be a danger to themselves or others. We won't rent to your family. Shouldn't you send them somewhere special? Let's hear Carol talk about attitudes.
Because you don't want to put any feelings that you have or attitudes that you have. They need to make their own decisions, you know. And I would try as hard as I could in that short time of that I had to have the conversation to try and have them to have an open mind. But some of the incidences that one father was just so, just adamant, you know. No matter what I said, it just wasn't going to work, you know. No, he was a Stanford graduate, and if his son... And, you know, because it oftentimes is father-son relationships. His son, I said, well, Aaron at that point, he was like 12, were you? I can't remember. But he was old enough that he was doing things, you know. He was, you know, in school and he was in, you know, art classes and, you know, he was doing a lot of different things. And and so he said to me, And what's your son doing today? And I said, well, you know, he's going to school. He's mainstream. He's doing this. And Aaron loves art. So, you know, his art projects. And he said, well, is he ever going to make it into college? And I said, probably not. But, you know, who knows? You know, the universe is open to him. He can do whatever his abilities allow him to do. And, you know, maybe he'll be in a junior college environment. I don't know. But, you know, he's progressing and he's happy and he has that opportunity open to him if it is something that he chooses or he has the capabilities to do so. And he said, no, he'll just push a broom around. That's all he'll do. There's always analogies to not accomplishing something and why pushing a broom seems to come out. It was just phenomenal to me that I heard that the second time. And then it reminded me back of when I had talked to a professional that said that to me, you know.
The Lanterman Act combats these attitudes. It respects the sanctity of all lives, freedom, a commitment to our fellow citizens. It assumes that with support and opportunity, all people can make their lives a blessing. After providing years of intensive care as a parent, it's hard to gradually let go. But my child has his own ideas, and he's learning to express them. With good public policy, people with disabilities don't have to trade liberty for care. Let's hear from Elizabeth.
Say this a lot. Your disability is only a mind thing. And the real disability is other people's attitudes. That's the real disability. We're just in bodies, or our minds may not work for us, but the real disabilities are how people perceive us. Their attitudes speak loud volumes of how they see us. And if that changes, I think this world would be a better place.
Before the 1980s, most people would have assumed that my son should be placed for his own good. The institution might have been called a school or a community, and it might have had a pool or beautiful grounds. Non-disabled staff might have lived there too. But it would have had all the hallmarks of an institution. Meals and activities chosen for clients by staff. There would be a lack of privacy in walls, locks, and gates to restrict access. All the choices my son would be presented would be part of a program model. Opportunities for personal growth would be limited by those choices and social interactions. Access to the outside community would be a field trip. A job would be a vocational program, likely with pay below the minimum wage. Separate isn't equal. How would my son react to this placement? Would he feel accepted, loved, cared for? Would he feel challenged, excited, motivated to work, learn, and experience new things? Congregating with people with disabilities together will always limit personal growth and fulfillment, no matter what the level of disability is. Grouping people together imposes efficiencies that overshadow the needs of individuals. It isn't just it's just not logistically possible to preserve choice and freedom when we group people together. For example, if one person has difficulty controlling their diet and needs the refrigerator locked, nobody is going to get their own snack. If one person wants to go to the movies and another one doesn't, one of them isn't going to go where they want to go. It's not fair. Congregate care forces good workers to make bad decisions. It's really actually impossible not to. Individual support in community settings is the only way that people can achieve their full potential. These problems start when you group as few as 5 people together. Additionally, objective research on housing and service models has consistently shown that congregating and clustering people together leads to worse outcomes on a full range of quality measures. Models that have been studied can be grouped into 3 types: dispersed housing, which is family-sized homes and neighborhoods; clustered housing, which is individual homes for people with disabilities that are clustered together to share services or supports; and congregate care, which is any housing with 5 or more disabled people living together on the same property who didn't specifically choose to live together. Both experience and consensus of experts is clear. Dispersed housing models outperform clustered and congregate care, and that should make sense to anyone who has needed things that don't fit into the standard benefits and programs that are offered. Federal and state policy is solidly against spending public money to build new congregate and clustered care projects. It's closing down the ones that currently exist. This is good public policy, and we should support it. It's based on solid research. Those who want to develop new congregate and clustered care models should be prepared to fund them for the long term without public support. Over time, segregation makes it harder to sustain funding. That means they become unstable and the quality goes down. Inclusion, on the other hand, builds public support. When we get to know and understand people, we care about them more. We vote for better policies. This strengthens the sustainability of good service models that benefit both individuals and society. Institutional models are being called things like intentional communities, farmsteads, workplay environments. Some people compare these new projects to summer camp. I like camp. I enjoy the activities and the camaraderie. But what would my life be like if my parents took me to camp and never picked me up? Going to camp is enriching, but living there indefinitely is not. Even people with significant intellectual disabilities benefit from broader experience. Other people compare clustered and congregate care models to assisted living or retirement communities for elders. But when elders choose these communities, they bring with them a lifetime of experiences and relationships. They privately fund them with their life savings, and they typically live there for a few years. This is very different than being isolated your whole life with a limited group of people whose social connections, experiences, and resources are also very limited. Some people confuse congregate and clustered models with village communities, such as La Arche. In village communities, disabled people and non-disabled people live together. They share their lives for free. It's not a service model. No staff is paid to provide care. This is not a model that can be broadly replicated. There have been many attempts to develop better congregate care, some of it well-funded, all of it well-intended. Even if they look good at first, these models just don't stand the test of time. People with disabilities should have the same opportunity to choose where they live. Many people want to live with family, but housing is a complex dynamic of availability, affordability, and accessibility. This is especially a problem in the Bay Area. Despite current challenges, significant improvements have been made in community-based housing services. For example, in partnership with the Golden Gate Regional Center, Brilliant Corners in San Francisco developed a new housing model, 962 homes. They're residential properties that are owned by a trust, separate from the service provider. This guarantees that residents cannot be moved from the property even if their service provider needs to be changed. 962 homes were developed as part of the closure of the Agnews Developmental Center in San Jose. Parents had concerns that community-based services would jeopardize their adult children with significant medical needs. Many of these former Agnews residents had spent most of their lives in congregate institutional settings. Let me tell you a story about Charles. He's a resident of Gordon Home in Redwood City. Charles' story is a story of no person left behind. He's 52 years old, and he was admitted to a state-run developmental center when he was 3.5. His mother and brother died, and he lost touch with his father. Charles is nonverbal. He has a diagnosis of profound intellectual disability. He also has complex medical needs. He has spastic quadriplegia and does not control his arms or legs. He gets his food through a tube in his stomach. He has difficulty moving his bowels, and he has severe sleep apnea. He needs to be monitored because he often needs oxygen. Charles communicates a lot with his eyes and his smile. A year and a half ago, a regional center team made up of social workers, service providers, consultants, and me came together, and we developed a community-based service plan that would integrate medical care and personal growth. It was challenging and time-consuming, but not impossible. The institution where he had lived his entire life outlined his needs. He can't tolerate being upright because it makes his breathing bad, so he has to stay in a hospital bed at all times. Okay, we need a gurney van so he can go to day program. If the electricity goes out, his equipment will fail. Okay, we need a generator. He needs to be monitored by a nurse at all times. Okay. We have a day program with a nurse, as well as a home in the neighborhood, a beautiful home with 24-hour nursing care on site. His bones are fragile. Okay. We have a ceiling-mounted lift and an adaptive bathroom. He needs a doctor who knows about developmental disabilities. We have Dr. Kripke, Director of Developmental Primary Care at UCSF. She's been caring for people like Charles for over 10 years. She already does home visits every couple months and is available by cell phone whenever we need her. She's also training the next generation of healthcare providers. We also have specialists and a hospital team we work with and a very experienced nursing staff. The local responders know the residents in the home already. Charles has intense individual needs, but so do many others. With resources that are locally available, if Charles can live successfully in the community, so can everyone else. With well-designed services and solid infrastructure beneath those services, people like Charles can thrive. We can create an array of reliable resources to support personal growth and community integration. There's another aspect of this care model that goes largely unreported. By meeting Charles' individual needs in the community, we not only improve his quality of life, we save the state money and stimulate local economies. While this model is expensive, it's still cheaper than serving Charles in a developmental center. This is truly a win-win situation. With good policy and appropriate funding, it can be sustained indefinitely. Charles moved to his new home after we had everything in place. With good planning, he was able to attend his day program in a gurney. Even from a hospital bed, he participated. At the first team meeting after his move, his day program coordinator talked about how he especially liked bowling. Bowling? Really? He's in a hospital bed. Oh, yes, she said. We have a ramp for the ball. I rigged up a pole he can push with hand-over-hand support. Let's see what that looks like.
This is it, Charlie. Big strike. Ready?
Ready, Charlie? Push.
One, two, three, go.
Good.
Hey! You love bowling. Fantastic, Charlie.
Charles' smile always lights up my day. In California, everybody, no matter how profound their needs, has a right to a meaningful life and to the services and supports they need to maximize their potential. No person left behind. Charles is still fragile. He had a serious hospitalization and required a tracheostomy to be placed so he can breathe. When he was stable, the hospital team suggested that he move to a skilled nursing facility because he needed one-on-one nursing care to suction his throat. But his team said no. We will hold a meeting with Dr. Kripke and representatives from his insurance company and from the regional center. We will get additional equipment and nursing hours we need, and he will come home. He came home, he's recovering well, and we've built his tolerance so he uses a wheelchair now. He's come a long way in a short time, but we're only beginning to explore the rich life that's possible. An assessment to see if he can learn to use a voice output communication device is next. When we move people from developmental centers into the community, we make a commitment that they will be better off on day one. And with the right attitudes, values, and teamwork, we can do it. It's up to Californians to continue to fearlessly implement the Lanterman Act. How do we support people who live in dispersed housing? If people with disabilities exercise their right to make choices, their needs are going to change as they learn and grow and have new experiences. They're going to develop new relationships. Their needs are also going to change as they develop medical problems and as they age. That means that any system of support is going to need to be flexible enough to evolve over time. I want to put something in place for my son before I die, and I want it to continue to meet his needs for as long as he's alive. Unfortunately, I can't. And if I try, I'm going to create something that's so inflexible that it won't provide him with the opportunity for a rich life. I can't know now who he's going to be in 10 years, much less in 30. It's challenging to set up services and supports, especially for someone like my son who needs one-on-one care. Parents do a lot of coordinating care. What will happen when I can't do it anymore? Will my son be left to the state? Is the state going to meet its obligation? Is my kid going to be bored or sick or forgotten, overwhelmed, imprisoned, abused, or lonely? It's scary to think about that. But Charles' story gives me hope. The regional center system has many challenges to face in the coming years. There are 21 regional centers for a population of 38 million. When the system was established, each regional center was to serve a population of 1 million. So technically, we're 17 regional centers short. One issue that's important in the Bay Area is that the state doesn't reimburse more in areas where the cost of living is more expensive. Social workers are required to have advanced degrees and work experience. They're underpaid. This leads to high turnover rates. They have heavy caseloads. This violates federal requirements. This could jeopardize federal matching funds to the state. Service programs have struggled with stagnant budgets and further cuts. Legislators need to step up. They need to step up to their own legal mandates. They're described in the Lanterman Act. The regional center system brings in $2 billion in federal money. The state needs to do its part in supporting an important world-class system. Fortunately, regional center leadership has partnered with local services to develop responsive, cutting-edge program models, which we can all be proud of. They help carry out the mandates of the Lanterman Act and can help address these challenges. The Office of Developmental Primary Care's CART model is one example of a program that needs support.
You know, so there's a much more cohesive group of people that are working to make it as best as it can possibly be. It still has a lot, needs to go a long way, and we need a lot more funding to get a lot of individual programs going. But in California, we are one of the best states. Now, if you go into Texas, which this friend that I was talking about, there's still, even to this day, 40 years later, there's areas that pushing the broom is, that's even thinking that that's a lot that they could do. You know, the attitude is totally different.
The most impressive result of the work of the Lanterman parents is that the children who we welcomed into the community and educated over the last 40 years are now setting their own policy agenda. The white paper, Keeping the Promise, Self-Advocates Defining the Meaning of Community Living, is one influential example. It's the basis of the new federal rules defining community. We need to listen, support, and follow. I know not everyone with an intellectual disability is able to participate equally in policy discussions, but if you go to meetings that are run by and for self-advocates, where the power dynamics and structure of the meeting is designed for access, where people listen to each other carefully, where people have received training and encouragement to speak for themselves and get support for their decisions, you'd be amazed at how many people meaningfully participate. Even people who have significant intellectual disabilities and communication challenges participate. The same people often have very little to say when in settings controlled by non-disabled people. We're only beginning to learn how to listen and how to support decisions. People with disabilities are showing us how. These are new opportunities for a new generation. We have to adjust. Today, young adults with disabilities are different, and so are the non-disabled peers with whom they grew up and went to school. They've never lived in institutions. They take it for granted that people with disabilities have a right to access. They got educations and adaptive equipment and iPads and email addresses and experience. They organize their peers. They joined youth leadership groups and learned to speak for themselves. And they vote. Now they aren't happy with a day program or shredding paper all day for less than minimum wage or living with roommates they didn't choose. They want regular jobs and families and a chance to pursue their interests. They want a chance to contribute as well as to receive support. And they want to direct their own services and to have supports designed around their needs. They want the ABLE Act passed so they can save money to achieve goals without losing the public benefits that they need to fund their supports. The ABLE Act allows people with disabilities to establish tax-exempt accounts to pay for qualified disability expenses. Without that legislation, people with disabilities can never escape from poverty. They need to stay poor in order to access the help they need. That isn't right. This legislation is still pending. Group homes, day programs, and vocational programs, which are smaller, sometimes still function like an institution. They fit clients into the structure of the program instead of supporting self-direction and choice. They were a step in the right direction for a generation who grew up in institutions, but they're not good enough for today. It isn't intuitive, but it actually turns out to be cost-effective to give people exactly what they want and need instead of plugging people into programs that provide more support and structure than is necessary. Supporting people's choice means more one-on-one attention, but there are fewer fixed administrative costs. Too much help, or the wrong type of help, actually leads to dependency. In fixed programs, supports remain in place even when they're no longer needed. When the people who get paid to provide supports are the ones who develop the plan, they rarely ask for less. Too much help can lead to protest behaviors when staff try to get clients to comply with their program. Parents and staff are used to doing things for people with disabilities and to making decisions for them. This is often easier than to step back and support. It's easy to underestimate people's competence and their potential. Let's hear from Melissa Crisp Cooper and her husband Owen.
Will they ever do before people you meet prefer to communicate with staff or whoever a family?
People prefer to communicate with staff or whoever else Melissa is with rather than with Melissa directly.
Or they assume that staff is responsible for me. And they do everything for me. And I think that I'm in community by myself.
They assume that staff sort of is your caretaker, or that you shouldn't be out in the community by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true even of some people, you know, that you know quite well, at least.
Who I thought understood who I was, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we've had neighbors ask things like that too that seem to indicate that
I'm not a very good understanding of.
That they don't have a good understanding of you and what you do and what you're about.
So a lot of assumptions. I get asked all the time who I'm with.
You get asked all the time who you're with.
Protecting people with disabilities from abuse and neglect is important. In congregate care, if there's a problem, you can't just shut the place down. There's too much at stake for too many people. You need proof and due process to fire someone. In dispersed models, if a resident doesn't like a service provider, they can simply replace them. We need to protect, but too much protection means that people can't take risks. Without taking risks that will have some bad experiences, we can't grow. There are some things that parents can't do, like care for our kids forever, but there's a lot that parents and the community members can do. We can make sure that the people who we entrust to take over when we're gone share our values and our vision. We can leave them the infrastructure that they need to deliver high-quality services. We can also honor the sacred trust that parents have willed to us. We can protect and uphold the Lanterman Act, and we can honor the legacy of the Lanterman parents by being good neighbors to their kids. We can model through our actions how we want people with disabilities to be treated now and in the future. We can make sure that adults with developmental disabilities are welcomed in our churches and our mosques and our synagogues. We can invite them to our homes. We can offer them jobs and buy the products of their microenterprises. We can visit them when they're sick. We can speak up about access problems, and we can make a place for them at the table when issues that affect them are being discussed. We can listen and honor the experience and wisdom that they bring. We can also give them rides when we go to Sacramento to talk to legislators. People with developmental disabilities are getting help, many of them beautiful supports. We can do better. We can distribute services more equitably. There are serious disparities. But again, there's really no question that the lives of people with disabilities are markedly better today than they were before 1977 when the Lanterman Act was passed. If we do the work, the next generation is going to be better off still. There are a lot of strengths to California's system, and one of them is the entitlement. Nobody is left behind, no matter how humble their origins or how great their service need. That is built into the system, and it's one of its most important features. No matter what happens, as long as there's an entitlement, nobody is left behind. We aren't starting from scratch. We have 40 years of experience in civil rights work behind us, and we have a plan. So let's begin to talk about what tools we have at our disposal and what we need to build. In addition to the Lanterman Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Olmstead decision are powerful tools. The Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination and ensures equal opportunity for people with disabilities in the areas of employment, government service, public accommodations, commercial facilities, and transportation. The Olmstead versus LC is a Supreme Court ruling that requires states to eliminate unnecessary segregation of people with disabilities. It ensures the right to receive services in integrated settings. No more congregate care, no going back, full access to community life. The Affordable Care Act is also a tool. We are reshaping how healthcare services are being delivered and funded in this country, and we can ensure that the needs of people with complex disabilities are addressed. This will require spending more on primary care. We need new payment models to support better ways to deliver healthcare for people who need it the most. The most recent tool is the Home and Community-Based Services Regulation from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Self-advocates fought to ensure this regulation defines community not just in terms of the location and size of housing and programs, but in terms of the ability of people to direct their own lives. It includes new standards for privacy, choice, integration, and access to real jobs in the community. This is a powerful tool to hold our legislators and regional centers accountable. Your handout has links to resources that describe how to use this to access the services your family needs. If the resources your family needs for good jobs, social activities, transportation, and staffing don't currently exist, take a look at the cool toolkit that was produced by the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network because it tells you your rights and how to exercise them. This is new, so it will take time to see results, but it's not too early to begin. There are many models of excellence that are cost-effective and can be scaled and expanded. Our spending should be based on what we know from 40 years of experience. We're a wealthy country, yet the money isn't getting spent on the right things. Maybe that has something to do with mind-boggling income inequality. The gap between what the richest people earn and what everybody else earns has grown significantly since the 1970s. Half the U.S. population lives in poverty or is low income. Most of the economic growth over the past 40 years has been with top earners. An unprecedented amount of our nation's wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few individuals. In 2009, the top 1% of households owned 35.6% of the nation's private wealth, which is more than the combined wealth of the bottom 90%. Our tax laws need to reflect our values and priorities. With some individuals in the Bay Area worth more than the budget of the entire regional center system that serves over 300,000 people, it's hard to believe that we can't properly fund cutting-edge service models. What are some of the things we need to build? Housing is a major issue. Where is all this dispersed housing going to come from? We need to work on a variety of strategies to increase the housing supply in law units, Section 8, set-asides and new developments, and better mechanisms to leave money and property in estate plans. For example, pooled special needs trusts allow us to leave some money, even a few thousand dollars, without making our kids ineligible for public benefits. But right now, more than half of adults with developmental disabilities live with their families, and that trend is likely to continue. It isn't a trend unique to adults with disabilities. Many non-disabled adult children are living with their parents, too. That is being driven by a number of forces such as aging baby boomers, income inequality, and the high cost of housing and education. We need to figure out how to take care of people, both parents and their kids, who are living together in multi-generational households. Parents can't do it alone, and we don't have to. Like the generation before us, we can go back to the state and share the responsibility more equitably with other taxpayers. The state is there to set policy, not to provide the services. We have successful public-private partnerships that need our support to remain flexible and responsive. We can also evolve the system to work more for families. We can beef up the services we provide in the home so families are assessed regularly. We can provide more support as parents age. We can employ people with disabilities in real jobs, earning real wages. We can change the laws which trap people in poverty as a condition for accessing public benefits. We can deliver health care in the home and train doctors. To achieve this, we need to build a solid infrastructure beneath the supports. The new home and community-based services regulations are leveraged to make that happen. The states are going to lose federal funding if they don't.
For a few years, I worked as a transition coordinator, supporting people in moving out of skilled nursing facilities. And I knew it to be true, but I was really surprised at the daily reality of so many people in skilled nursing facilities are not there because of their impairments or health conditions, but because of the lack of supports that they have to live in the community. I would meet people who would be fine managing their disability, but they just didn't have housing. And if you have 874 SSI check and no family, you know, that's not enough to live in the Bay Area. So that was really, it's a difficult reality to accept, and I don't think we should. But when I was working to help people, supporting people in moving out, what I often found too is we have to have a bigger conversation than let's just get people out. But what do we need to do as a community and as people that support integration to make sure that it's not just a change of geographic location? The actual lived experience would be different. If somebody is living in their apartment and the only person that they see is an attendant that stops by 3 days a week, that's not a very meaningful life. Unfortunately, I've even worked with people that they wanted to go back to nursing home because at least they were around people. And so I think we need to do a lot more around what does it mean to have a meaningful life. And I think of like the opportunity to contribute and like how much of that is a part of making us feel human or being in a part of our humanity, and that needs to be a part of our planning and our thinking as we're supporting people with disabilities.
Since 1997, local stakeholders, including the ARC and the Health Plan of San Mateo and the Golden Gate Regional Center, in collaboration with the Office of Developmental Primary Care, have been developing the CART model. The CART model is an organized system of care. The CART model is part of the infrastructure that enables quality community living. The CART model is a new way of delivering healthcare services to people with developmental disabilities. CART stands for Clinical Services, Advocacy, Research, and Training. The CART model is more than just medical care. It's a holistic approach to improving quality of life. One of the main reasons why people end up in institutions or moving away from home is that their medical needs aren't met. Our goal is to make sure that everyone has access to the healthcare services they need to maximize their potential. There are four functional components of the CART model. The first component is enhanced primary care. These are primary care services that are designed to meet the needs of adults with complex disabilities. The second component is health advocacy services. Health advocacy services are the direct support to help people partner effectively with their healthcare providers, going to appointments, supporting communication, and following through on the healthcare plan. The third component is a yearly nurse health assessment. This is a comprehensive, standardized assessment by a developmental disability nurse with recommendations. With your permission, the results will be fed back to your family, your doctors, and your case coordinators. Data from these assessments will also help us understand the services that people need. The fourth component is a CART center. The CART center is a hub of experts in developmental primary care that provide clinical service, policy advocacy, research, training, and technical assistance. If you want to learn more about the work of the Office of Developmental Primary Care, visit our website, odpc.ucsf.edu. The web address is on your handout.
So I manage getting my daily needs met by working with attendants and care providers. I do this in two ways. So the first way is that I receive nursing services through a home health agency. And it's actually really difficult and really stretches me, which is why in my menu of care, I choose to have more attendants than nurses. With an agency, you often don't actually get to pick the person that you work with. They don't even want you to even interview them. They expect that the nurse shows up at your house and they work. If you say that you don't like the nurse, it's a big, big problem. And it's not just the staff at the agency, but it's kind of the medical model culture of home health agency providers in that kind of sense. So it's really difficult. The one nurse I work with, I've worked with her 2 years, and we plan, I think, to work together for a long time. And it works because she respects my self-determination and is willing to work with me within agency guidelines and sometimes in a broader sense.
Another part of the infrastructure that we need to build to support self-determination is the technology to find and manage direct support workers. Right now, if people want to choose their own workers and their own supporters and design their own services, they're forced to become a mini human resources department. There's a heavy responsibility for hiring and scheduling and supervising and training workers. It's complicated to manage payroll. We can help people find compatible workers and pay them without requiring people with disabilities and their families to understand the details of employment law and public benefits. A group of disability advocates has developed a startup venture called My Support to meet this need.
So in addition to receiving those home health nursing services through the agency, I'm also eligible and receive personal care attendant services. And so what that means for me is I work with four different attendants. Most of them I've worked with for, almost 3 years. So since I first arrived to the Bay Area. And then one of them is a friend who picked up some work. And that's really nice because a lot of times it feels more like it's our social time, but I'm also getting my needs met.
Within the CART framework, we've developed a comprehensive series of proposals for system change. For clinical, the proposals include two kinds of primary care service: consultation and assessment services, and home care services for people who have more intensive medical needs. For health advocacy, we're working with the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network and the ARC of California to introduce supported healthcare decision-making legislation. This legislation would create a new legal status for people who provide support to people with disabilities to make healthcare decisions and implement their healthcare plans. It's voluntary. Unlike a power of attorney or conservatorship, it doesn't transfer healthcare decision-making to another person. But with the consent of the person with a disability, it allows supporters to access confidential information in order to provide support. It also provides legal protection to clinicians who respect choices that are made with support. It requires a notary, but no legal proceedings to implement an agreement. People with intellectual disabilities who might not be considered competent to sign other kinds of contracts can still enter into an agreement. We're also working on helping people complete their own advance directives to ensure that their wishes for end-of-life care are respected. With help from a supporter, the Thinking Ahead program helps people with intellectual disabilities to make decisions and complete their paperwork. Let's see how clinicians can support the communication and decision-making of people with disabilities.
Hi, Erin. My name is Jerry. I'm one of the nurse practitioners in the practice.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. So we're going to spend a few minutes talking. I know you brought your mom with you today, and she's in the waiting room.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to talk with you first, and then if you'd like, we can bring your mom in, but that's up to you.
Okay.
Okay? Okay, great. So tell me, how have you been feeling overall?
Overall, I have not been feeling too well because of my health issue. And the reason why is because of that is because I have, let's say, inguinal bowel syndrome. When I do see doctors, I need to have someone come with me, like a family member or non-family member, and they have the tendency of over talking for me, and that leads into conversation with other doctors, and that kind of seems help for me. But I don't have the power and willing to talk to them physically.
Okay. Sounds like you know quite a bit about your irritable bowel, mm-hmm. and you know quite a bit about how to manage it, actually, and how to even anticipate when it might act up.
Yep.
But the other thing I heard you say is that it's really important for me to talk directly to you and not just to the people that come with you, that it's important for you to be able to communicate right back, right in front with me. So maybe the people that do come with you to help support you, it's good to maybe have them come in and you let me know if this is correct at the end of the visit, so they kind of hear the same thing that you hear in terms of what we've talked about today and what the plan is. So they can help you with carrying out the plan? Does that sound reasonable?
Reasonable.
Okay, good.
Yay. Go, Jerry. For research, we have proposals to study the health status of the population of people with developmental disabilities and to study the effectiveness of our innovations. For training and technical assistance, we have a proposal to develop the CART Center to grow our successful training programs and technical assistance resources. We train clinicians to provide health education for self-advocates, direct support staff, professionals, and families. To illustrate the CART model, let me present a hypothetical case. Let's say you're the parent of a man who's graduated from special education. Currently, your regional center case coordinator might ask you what your goals are for your child, your adult child. She might show you various group homes, day programs, and vocational programs. If you want your child to remain in your home, your case coordinator might offer you some respite hours. You might not like everything you're shown. Most likely, it'll only be a partial fit. If you don't like what you see, your case coordinator basically puts it back on you to come up with an alternative. You might think about conservatorship because you fear that your son won't be able to, that you're not going to be able to support your son's healthcare needs without it. That feels overwhelming. It doesn't have to be this way. With a few tweaks and targeted investments in some new infrastructure, we can build on 40 years of success. We can adjust our system to current realities. Once we have the infrastructure built, our vision will lead to a different outcome. It's based on person-centered planning. Person-centered planning is an ongoing problem-solving process used to help people plan for their own futures. The first thing your regional center case coordinator does is invite your child's family, friends, and supporters to a person-centered planning meeting. In person-centered planning, the group focuses on your son's vision and what he wants to do in the future. The team meets to identify opportunities to develop personal relationships, participate in the community, and increase control over his own life. It supports him to develop the skills and abilities to achieve his goals. The team has information to work from because your son has been getting his yearly nurse health assessment. There's comprehensive information available about his support, medical, and behavioral needs. Your son is able to participate in the meeting because your family did training and supported decision-making. Your family has been practicing. He does better when he knows in advance what questions he'll be asked and when he's given examples and choices. Let's say your son says he wants to find a girlfriend, work with animals, improve his fitness, and live in the in-law unit downstairs. Instead of plugging him into an existing program, a program can now be built around his goals. He can go to the monthly dance at the Arc and attend the health class on sexuality that's offered by the CART Center. There's a group of other adults from his old school who he used to hang out with. The team can assign someone to contact them to see if they want to use some of their personal assistance hours to hire an aide who can organize a club that meets in their homes in the evenings. One of the Circle of Support members has a good collection of DVDs that he's willing to loan to the club. The team also looks into Special Olympics swim team. The state has developed incentives and supports for employment in real jobs as required by the new home and community-based services regulations. There are three ideas for working with animals: a vocational program at the zoo, or supported employment in a therapy dog program, or the local aquarium shop where your son often visits to look at the fish. The case coordinator will get your son signed up with vocational rehabilitation to look into the zoo program. Others are assigned to make inquiries at the dog training and aquarium shops. Your son also has some significant medical and behavioral needs. He has seizures that can be serious, and he's been having severe meltdowns. He hasn't been eating much since he graduated from school. The regional center case coordinator budgets that you're going to need 4 hours a day of personal assistance hours and 4 hours per day of job coaching to implement this plan. Also, a case coordinator offers transportation and a referral to the CART Center consult clinic. The experts at the CART Center can help diagnose the meltdowns and the decreased appetite. To hire the personal assistant and job coach, you help your son log on to My Support. You put in the hours you need and answer questions that help match you to a worker who's compatible. Your son doesn't like female aides who baby him. A matching algorithm helps you to find two staff, a hip young man who likes animals and a woman who's a nursing student. Once you select your workers, My Support helps them get their employment paperwork done and get paid by various agencies. It helps you with the scheduling and tracking hours of the staff that your staff can work. Your son and your son's workers get text messages from my support to remind them of their shifts. You've loaded old assessments, medical records, and other key documents onto my support, and you help your son grant his new workers access to the ones that they need. There's also a seizure and a bowel movement tracking form on my support that you and his aides keep updated. You're also taking care of your mother, so you can't accompany your son to all those appointments. Your son fills out a supported healthcare decision-making agreement with his aide, who agrees to help him with his medical care. This plan works until your son has a bad seizure and ends up in the hospital. Your son's Thinking Ahead Advanced Directive was filled out at his yearly nurse health assessment. It was uploaded onto the My Support site. Your son's worker was able to give it to the doctors when he arrived at the hospital, along with a summary of his medical care from his CART Center medical consult. The members of the club, including your son's girlfriend, come to visit at the hospital and send him cards. After discharge, your son's health is more fragile. He's incontinent, and you're exhausted. A new person-centered planning meeting is convened, and your son is referred to the CART Center's home care service. A CART Center primary care doctor does a home visit every 2 months as needed, and she consults by phone with the neurologist so your son doesn't have to make as many follow-up appointments. If he doesn't feel well, the CART Center nurse comes to do assessments. The home care service administrative staff works with the disability care manager at your son's health plan to expedite getting a hospital bed with safety rails. Your son's personal assistance hours are increased to 12 hours per day, and he becomes a client of the ARCS Professional Health Advocacy Program. A professional health advocate now helps your son manage his health care. You log on to My Support to hire a new worker for the additional hours. Your son cancels the supported healthcare decision-making agreement with his old aide and develops new agreements with the health advocates from the ARC. Your son has his yearly nurse health assessment, and as part of the assessment, the nurse does a vision screen and recommends a referral for new glasses. She also notes worsening dental hygiene and recommends a CART Center training for your son's aides and a referral to the special needs dental clinic. She also does a caregiver assessment and learns that you've been depressed since your mother died and haven't been able to provide as much attention to your son. Your regional center case coordinator adds a service broker to your son's plan to assist with coordinating all the services and workers. The nurse encourages you to get some supportive counseling, and after talking to your family agrees to go to church together every week to reconnect with each other and with your community. The planning process and the infrastructure is flexible. It allows you to ramp up services as needed to meet your individual needs up to and including full staffing. You and your son retain choice of staff, and you don't have to become an employment agency. The regional center, vocational rehab, community agencies, My Support, and the CART model work together as a system to ensure your family's needs are met. No longer do you need to rely on rigid, one-size-fits-all programs that don't have the flexibility to respond to your son's changing needs. Self-directed planning, combined with modular, community-based resources, gives your son just the right amount of care and support. It provides the foundation for your son to live his life to the fullest. People with disabilities are the experts in what's best for them. If we follow, they will lead. This infrastructure that I'm describing isn't yet built. We need your help to build and fund it. Because of the lessons we've learned through experience and research, this is the direction that public policy is going. The sooner that we embrace it, the stronger it will be. If you want to support this vision, you can make a donation to the Office of Developmental Primary Care, and this will help us to promote comprehensive community-based policies. Financial contributions translate directly into quality care for our most vulnerable citizens. Also, if you want to join our email list, our policy partners, the ARC of California and the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, can provide you with action alerts. Got some time for questions. Thanks. I want to let you know that we live our values too, Aaron Abel was production assistant. You met him in several of the clips and was present at all of the videotaping and helped keep us on track. And it's part of his job and vocational program to participate in the video making. So we want to thank him and the talent in the video clips, the Golden Gate Regional Center, Ari Naiman and Sam Crane of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network for their leadership, and the Shaw Family Fund and the Special Hope Foundation for their support.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kripke. That was provocative, as always. So let's open it up to some questions from the audience.
So the question is, what resources do we have in the Bay Area, in community college, a church, unified schools?
When young children go to school,
When young children go to school, well, children are entitled to a free, appropriate education in the least restrictive setting. That means that all kids are entitled to an education and access to the general curriculum if they're able to benefit from it. And people of all intellects benefit from broad experiences and exposure to non-disabled people. So we certainly have a robust special education program in San Francisco, as well as regional resources for school districts that can't meet the needs. I'm sure everybody has examples of ways that they would like it to improve, but we do have a system of care in place. I think the infrastructure is there, the ideas are there, the basics are there. We need to take it to the next level. Excellent question. Is my support available to patients who are not UCSF? My support is a startup, and it has not launched yet, so it's not available to anybody at the moment, but will be soon. And yes, the idea is that it will be broadly available and to people with disabilities of all types, not necessarily just to people with developmental disabilities. The question is the idea of providing healthcare in the home widely implemented yet, or is this still in the idea stage? The Office of Developmental Primary Care has been serving people with complex disabilities living in group homes now since 2007, and that's been a very successful model. We have not developed a home care service for developmental disabilities for people who are living in family homes at this time, but we do have a proposal. We do have a proposal available for funding if anybody in this room should want to fund it.
I'm going to make a comment also that home-based programs are few and far between, and there's a growing need for more home-based care as the population ages. So the waiting lists, unfortunately, are very long for home-based programs. But they're, I think, the wave of the future for many individuals to be able to get comprehensive care.
And in defense, the Affordable Care Act is in the process of being implemented, and there's a lot of movement right now to change the funding that would enable more home care. The barrier to developing more home care services is really the payment structure of our healthcare system, which I have great hope is in the process of being revised. But if we are not at the table saying what we need and what it's going to cost and what it's going to look like, then it won't look like how we want it to look. So we need to be at the table. The question was about in-home support services, which are funded usually through Medicaid, through special agreements between the federal government and the states, which are called home and community-based services waivers. And those waivers are agreements that allow states to spend extra money on special populations like people with developmental disabilities. And every state has a waiver like that. As I mentioned and yes, states have been, you know, we've had an economic downturn and vulnerable people usually are targeted when money is tight, but the economy is in a different place right now. Plus, we have the opportunity to think about new tax structures that are more fair and that distribute wealth and income more equitably. And we absolutely need to fund these very cost-effective services, home care, home support services, so that people can access care in the community and not go back to congregate care, which is more expensive and not as good quality of life. So if I understand your question, it's that you've visited some congregate care settings, farmsteads and other kinds of congregate care settings, and they seem attractive and nice, and the people there seem to be enjoying themselves, and so should that be an option? And are some of the community options not very desirable? There's a lot we need to do to make the community more desirable, and that's part of the infrastructure we need to build. But people with disabilities, when they visit these locations, notice things, in my experience, that parents and non-disabled people don't notice. So saying that they're nice places, I think you really need to dig a little bit deeper and not just look at the facility and the activities, but dig a little bit deeper. There's no self-advocacy organization in the United States that supports those people who've actually lived in those kinds of settings, that supports building new ones, and they all support closing down the ones that exist. So I think we really need to listen to the people who've actually lived there about what they prefer. And again, there's issues around sustainability, because sometimes things can be nice for a period of time. That staff attitude, it's interesting that you brought up some of these programs. I was just at a conference, you were probably at the same conference, where people were standing up, and I was noting how the people who were describing congregate care, instead of talking, the talk was about, we had this idea for this garden program and we thought it was so fabulous, and when we actually got the people there, it didn't work at all. That was one, and we had to abandon it because our wonderful ideas about this garden didn't turn out to be something that people actually wanted to do. And they also talked about organizational culture and how difficult it was to maintain the right attitude among the staff, and they were actually talking about wearing T-shirts that had slogans on them to try to remind people how they should behave. You know, when you choose your own staff, you don't have to remind people how to behave. This just happens naturally, and it can be the same person working in that kind of environment who behaves one way, and then they move to a smaller, more natural setting, and they behave a different way. It's a structural problem. It's not mean people, or you can't do this with slogans or organizational culture. It's just not logistically possible to meet the needs of people who have really diverse kinds of needs and interests in a congregate care setting. It just doesn't work. And you're already seeing that even in these really well thought through, really well intentioned, really well funded projects that aren't even full. They only have 5 people living there, and they're already starting to have these kinds of problems. And if you knew what to listen for, as you were listening to them describe their problems and what challenges they were having, what I was describing was already happening in these brand new startups.
That was a long answer.
Sorry.
Sounds like no.
Don't build them. That's like the bottom line. Do not build these things. Bad idea. So the question is, what is the definition of community? And it's beautifully articulated in the Keeping the Promise document, and I can give you the reference for it, but self-advocates have told us what community is, and it's about self-direction. It's not about the location or the number of people, but it's the ability to control your life. So can I lock the door? Can I choose to go where I want to go to the same degree that anybody else does? Can I do what I want to do to the degree that somebody else does? And this is not high functioning, low functioning. I don't make those distinctions. Everybody has individual needs, and everybody has interests and ways that they want to pursue their life. And living in the community means full integration for everybody. regardless of service need, regardless of support need. So I just to repeat for the mic, Dr. Parisi was telling us that people communicate their choices in different ways. Some people can tell us what they want using words or writing or using an augmentative communication device, but there are some people who tell us what's good for them through their behavior and their facial expressions and other ways of communicating. And if we really listen to people, then they can direct their own lives and they can make choices and they'll tell us what they want, what's good for them. One of the problems with congregate care, it's very hard once you're there, the infrastructure takes on a life of its own. It's very hard to move out. If people start moving out, then it becomes underfunded. And so the people who have care in custody have a very strong motivation to keep people from moving out. And if you've ever done an individual education plan for your child, you know that staying put is the easiest thing to do. And that's the same thing with congregate care. Staying put is the easiest thing to do. It's very hard with that care model to make adjustments because you get a certain inertia that's very difficult to break through. And we've experienced that now. We've been closing down institutions for 40 years and we've done this over and over. It's hard to move people out. Even if they have clearly expressed the desire to move out. A lot easier. And I'm not saying that the group homes that we have today, many of them function very much like institutions, and that's part of what this new regulation is about, is that type of group home that functions very much like an institution is no longer going to be acceptable. Dr. Parisi is asking about cost effectiveness, and there is data on self-direction. There is data. I mean, we certainly know that it's cheaper to serve people in the community than it is in institutions. There's plenty of data on that, and that's part of why we've been closing down institutions and why Ronald Reagan signed the Lanterman Act, because he was a fiscal conservative. And I imagine he was a very nice man who wanted to help people with disabilities, but I think his primary motivation was that he was a fiscal conservative. So there's no question that serving people in the community is less expensive. The question is, can I explain the meaning of my logo? Thank you for asking that question. It conjures a variety of things for me. One of them is the rainbow spectrum, which I think is the rainbow colors are a symbol of neurodiversity, and the Office of Developmental Primary Care applies the social model of disability and the neurodiversity models of disability to our practice. The circles are circles of support and person-centered planning, so you can imagine people in the centers there. You see different circles, which are these different agencies and organizations and systems that work together to support people. Those are the kinds of images that are conjured by this logo to me. So I think the question is that you're experiencing all of the problems with the system, that you're getting older and the infrastructure to support your son's self-direction isn't in place yet. The housing's not there. The services aren't there. The My Support isn't there. The CART model's not there. And you want a solution for him that's going to last forever, that you can choose now and that will last for him when you're gone. That's an appealing idea. I certainly understand why people want that, but the problem with it is that it's very restricting, and is any choice you make today is not going to meet his needs tomorrow, because we don't know who he's going to be. Nobody can predict who he's going to be tomorrow. So I think, I'm not sure what the question is, but I'll try to repeat for the microphone as best I can, that you're interested in working on this vision, on bringing it to life. What do we do in the meantime? Because my kid's got needs and I'm tired. Well, individuals need to do what they need to do for themselves and for their families. And we have to deal with our current realities, even if we have a vision. So we work towards a vision. And then, you know, I don't judge people for making decisions today, but I strongly advise that we not work on bad policy and that we build good infrastructure, not go back to the failed policies and the failed service models of the past. So she says, you're interested in continuing this forum. Right on.
Excellent.
Come on. Sign up. We'll continue this conversation.
We're going to end with that. Let's continue this forum because that is something that needs to happen. And I want to thank Dr. Kripke for always being thought-provoking and visionary. And let's keep discussing this. It's really important. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.